The following is For Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
Beheading back to war, the outrageous execution of an American journalist adds to pressure for escalating military intervention in Iraq and Syria.
Race, force, and justice beyond Ferguson. The Attorney General comes and the National Guard goes, leaving more peaceful streets but a lingering national debate.
The trouble with tech, how digital dominance is disrupting our laws, our lives, even what it means to be human.
Living September Song, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Lucinda Franks writes of her 40-year union with legendary prosecutor Robert Morgenthau, 30 years her senior.
The Fiddler File. You know the songs. The new book Tradition tells how Fiddler on the Roof came together and to stages and screens worldwide to this day.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only. Now a project of the nonprofit New York Foundation for the Arts. For your ears only, for the week of August 24th, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. A situation in which there will no longer be anyone left to help. That's what Russian officials said they were determined to avoid by sending a convoy with humanitarian aid across the Ukraine border to areas controlled by pro-Russian separatists, without Kiev's okay. Also last week, Moscow shut down the city's flagship McDonald's, officially for health reasons, though many saw it as retaliation for U.S. sanctions. If they really cared about people's health, said one Muscovite, they wouldn't have let it open in the first place. Now this.
Today, the entire world is appalled by the brutal murder of Jim Foley by the terrorist group ISIL. The United States of America will continue to do what we must do to protect our people. We will be vigilant and we will be relentless. From governments and peoples across the Middle East, there has to be a common effort to extract this cancer so that it does not spread.
The bloody beheading of journalist John Foley and the threat that a second U.S. citizen's life may be at stake suddenly made other Americans take personally the spread of Islamic State terrorism from Syria to Iraq. And it posed perhaps the biggest challenge yet to Barack Obama if it pushes him back to the battle he campaigned so successfully against to get to the White House. Even short of that, there was controversy over the way Obama responded to the ISIS crisis and domestic controversy over race and fatal police force between rounds of golf while vacationing on Martha's Vineyard.
Washington was also buzzing about the politically charged indictment of Texas Governor Rick Perry for alleged abuse of power just as he was restoring his image for another possible presidential run, and about continuing signs that Republicans might win back the Senate this November. To consider these and other developments of the week, for your ears only, we're joined again by veteran TV commentator Eleanor Clift, also a contributor at thedailybeast.com. Welcome back to the program.
Glad to be with you.
Even before the Foley execution, we saw increased U.S. air attacks on Islamic State fighters around Mosul. And now there's talk of expanding them to extremist bases back in Syria, where some of our special operations troops earlier tried to rescue the journalist. How far back to war do you see Obama taking the country?
Well, I think he's drawing the line at nation building and at putting boots on the ground. But I think you've heard the case being made these last few days by the administration that the border between Iraq and Syria is basically non-existent, and that if they're going to continue to hit ISIS, that they may have to go into Syria. What I'll be interested to see if it happens, where the U.S. is in Iraq, partly at the invitation of the Iraqi government, let's see if Syrian President Assad will invite the U.S. in to mount these airstrikes, because Assad is battling ISIS as well. It just shows how complicated all these geopolitical alliances are. Sometimes, you know, your worst enemy becomes your ally.
And, of course, those special operations troops don't fight in flip-flops. They do wear boots. But meanwhile, are the White House, Senate, and House leaders just as happy that Congress is not in session now when the fury over Foley could trigger a too hasty overreaction?
I think Congress is happy to let the president make this decision, but you can see in the polls that have been taken and also just kind of listening to the statements made by various politicians that there seems to be now support for airstrikes because the behavior of ISIS is so brutal.
You talked about ISIS with veteran diplomat John Negroponte, our ambassador in Iraq, when U.S. forces there released Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who later became the ISIS leader. Does Negroponte have any regrets?
He said he did not recall specifically any discussion about releasing Baghdadi after he had been detained in Iraq, but he talked about how the political pressure that he and other American officials got from the various sheikhs who would call up and say, well, I know this person, he's not a terrorist, please let him go. And he basically said, you know, we got those pressures and sometimes we gave into them. And he said that he didn't think that we, you know, should beat ourselves up over that, that sometimes those things happen. But I think his larger regrets came across when he said that the way that U.S. should proceed is to limit our response to counterterrorism and to carefully avoid recreating the situation that existed when President Bush was in the White House, which was a much broader effort of trying to change the government and the society in Iraq.
Policy aside, are you surprised that Obama permitted himself to be pictured going back to golf after periodic statements about Foley and the issues of race, violence, and injustice in Ferguson, Missouri?
Not at all, because I think it's in keeping with the attitude that he has projected ever since he won re-election, that he's not going to worry about what he sees as sort of petty carping. And, you know, every president has gotten criticism for going on vacation at inopportune moments. And there was, you know, a famous scene of President Bush delivering a very sober message and then literally turning around while the cameras were on him and saying, "See this," as he showed off his tee shot. And I think if you examine the vacation periods of recent presidents, this one has been away from the White House for fewer days than his predecessors. And if you want to get really crass about it, if the extremists are watching and they see him continuing to play golf and continuing to smile, I think they can see that even beheading an American citizen is not going to, you know, bring this country to its knees.
What do you make of the Rick Perry indictment? Mostly political, but maybe backfiring as Perry exploits it to rally support?
The prosecutor that brought the indictment, it's a Democratic area, and so there is some partisan politics. But if you read the Texas papers, they've got a pretty solid case against the governor. This is going to be fought out over a period of months. And if, in fact, the governor is cleared, you know, then it's a big win for him, and he will have rallied his base. And I suppose even if he's convicted, Republican primary voters may still think he's a hero. But I think, it's a problem going forward. You don't like indicted after your name if you're competing for the presidency.
There's also been some interesting comment on the libertarian appeals being made by Kentucky Senator Rand Paul and the minimal response so far by millennials he might hope to attract. How do you see that?
Well, I give Rand Paul credit for he's trying to remake and to modernize the Republican Party. Problem is, when you examine his positions, I mean, he's opposed to, you know, same-sex marriage. He's kind of a checkered history on civil rights. He doesn't seem to support issues that, you know, young people would rally to. So I must say the trip he took to Guatemala, where he joined with other medical personnel and was operating as an eye surgeon on people there, that was very good publicity for him, and he brought along a whole team of camera people and political consultants, so you can see him beginning to put together a presidential campaign.
How do you see the victory of so many mainstream Republicans over Tea Party primary candidates affecting the war for Senate control in November?
Well, the Republicans have good candidates this time. They don't have people who can be caricatured as so far out there that they can't possibly win. So it's going to be a very hard-fought campaign for the Senate. The Republicans, when you look at the states, I think six of the seven most competitive races are states where Mitt Romney won by large margins. And so it should be kind of an easy takeover for Republicans. But when you go state by state, even some of the most vulnerable Democrats in red states like Louisiana and North Carolina, they're doing well. They're holding their own, and the Democrats have some marquee candidates in Michelle Nunn in Georgia and Allison Grimes in Kentucky.
Veteran TV commentator Eleanor Clift is also a contributor at thedailybeast.com.
Quote from the news, "We've been able to breathe a sigh of relief, at least for the time being." That was Ryan Larson at RBC Capital Management. As the Dow closed above 17,000 for the first time since July, existing home sales rose to a 10-month high, and claims for unemployment fell.
Next, race, force, and justice in Ferguson and beyond for your ears only. We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. Here we go again. That was Russell Moore, president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention, disdaining new federal guidelines that specify which and how certain religious nonprofit and for-profit operation can pass Obamacare's mandate for contraceptive coverage to insurance companies on grounds of conscience. Now this.
My hands are up. You're gonna kill him.
Oh, they got their guns out.
Stop it, bro.
Oh, he just killed this man.
Damn.
Oh, here we go again. They just killed this man.
The national outcry we have seen speaks to a sense of mistrust and mutual suspicion that can take hold in the relationship between law enforcement and certain communities.
If there was ever any question that excessive force can come too easily to some cops, especially when race is involved, it was right there on TV last week. In Ferguson, Missouri, where the African-American majority was still angrily protesting a white cop's fatal shooting of unarmed black teen Michael Brown, another policeman was led away and later suspended after threatening a journalist with his weapon raised. In nearby St. Louis, two cops gunned down an obviously disturbed black man with a knife who actually asked to be killed, but could have been tasered or just wounded.
Ferguson itself quieted down after U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder came to town following a detachment of federal investigators, and state National Guard troops began to leave. But a local prosecutor, little trusted by the black community, refused to recuse himself from the case, and there were questions about the grand jury proceedings, as it was reported that the policeman who killed Brown had never filed a complete incident report on exactly what happened and why. To consider those developments and the larger issues of police force, race, and justice, for Your Ears Only, we're joined again by Ellis Coase, author of The End of Anger, A New Generation's Take on Race and Rage from Echo Books. He's also executive producer, host, and writer for Against the Odds, a multimedia documentary series on overcoming adversity. Welcome back to the program.
My pleasure.
Let's start with the community of Ferguson. From what you've read and know, how can such a large African-American majority not be reflected in local elected government, which could do a lot to make the police department more racially balanced?
Well, sure it could. And I think the answer is fairly straightforward. I mean, first of all, Ferguson is not Chicago or Los Angeles. This is a small community, barely 20,000 people. And it's recently majority black. It was 40 years ago, it was overwhelmingly white. Did not gain a black majority until the year 2000, where it barely gained a majority. It was only in the year the last census that you had a two-thirds black majority there. And so there's, one, there's a natural lag. Two, it's a community that has not been very well organized politically, socially, or any other way. And three, as is true with many communities, there's a lot of alienation and a lot of people of color, a lot of black citizens there just didn't particularly see any reason to get involved in the political processes. But before we go on, I think I should also make another point. When we talk about these kinds of incidents like the one that happened in Ferguson, there's a huge historical context to this. I mean, one of the reasons that I got involved in journalism in the first place was because as a kid growing up in Chicago in the 60s, there were two riots that ripped through my community, you know, one in 66, the other in 68. The Watts riot in 65 grew out of a police incident. The riot in Detroit in 67 grew out of a police incident. The riot in Los Angeles in 92, in Miami in 1980, in St. Petersburg in 1996, they were in one way or another connected either directly or indirectly to police incidents.
Do you think President Obama should already have paid a visit or should go sometime soon now that violence has subsided?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think that Eric Holder went and he obviously was very emotionally affected by it. The White House has been very proactive. I mean, I was on a phone call a week or so ago where they reached out to what they called stakeholders and explained that the president was going to speak, explained that Eric Holder was going to be visiting. And part of this, and these so-called stakeholders were people involved in issues of race equality, of community organizing, who are working with young black men, a huge national constituency that they are basically trying to assure that they are on top of this situation in Ferguson and are doing all that they can. I mean, certainly when hurt for Obama to visit, but one of the things that has come out, not just from this incident, but from other incidents since his presidency, is that it's very politically loaded whenever Obama gets anywhere near a story that has to do with race and particularly with race and the cops. I mean, I think we saw this several years ago. What was it, 2009, I guess, with Skip Gates, when the president took a position that the vast majority of whites, as the polls revealed later, had huge problems with. Trayvon Martin was not a case of police abuse, but it was still a case of a young black man getting gunned down. And again, you know, the president took a position where he seemed to be particularly sympathetic to Trayvon Martin. And again, there was a huge negative reaction to that. So I think the president has learned, you know, in during his tenure, is that for him as the president of the United States, you know, to get involved in these incidents in any sort of personal way or to indicate that he is favoring one side or the other is very, very freighted politically.
On a national level, would you support mandatory mini cameras on all police uniforms to keep them within proper guidelines and protect them from unfair charges of impropriety?
I think it's a good idea. I have to confess, David, I'm not an expert in the technology of surveillance and mobile technology that would allow that to happen. But I think so whether it's mini cams on uniforms or some other way, you know, that allows us and allows the police departments to have a much better sense of what's happening out there and have some reality check, I think absolutely, that's needed.
From working on your last book of The End of Anger, A New Generation's Take on Race and Rage, what steps would you suggest for Ferguson and places like it where race and rage still present significant problems?
Well, I think, first of all, an acknowledgement that there is this huge sense of grievance and sense of unfair treatment out there. I mean, Pew released a poll last week, and so did the New York Times, which has said, what every poll that has ever asked about these questions has always said since I've been looking at this issue, which is several decades, and basically that there is a fundamental breach, gap, division, however you want to characterize it, between how African Americans in general see treatment of their communities and themselves when it comes to police, and how white communities see this treatment, whereas the majority of African-American males report incidents of being stopped by cops, of being discriminated against by cops, and virtually no whites come up with such incidents. And what that contributes to is a huge gap in understanding. You know, whites, and many whites, have a difficult time understanding why so many blacks respond so emotionally to these kinds of issues and why blacks tend to be so eager, for lack of a better word, to leap to the conclusion that discrimination is part of the problem when it comes to these kinds of confrontations. And then beyond that, I mean, a lot of what needs to happen has to do with simple changes in police procedures and training of cops, you know, who too often are left to their own devices when it comes to operating in communities that are very tense.
Ellis Kosis' latest book is The End of Anger, A New Generation's Take on Race and Rage from Echo Books. He's also executive producer, host, and writer for Against the Odds, multimedia documentary series on overcoming adversity.
Quote from the news, "The emergence of Monet is a great relief." That was James Peterson, director of Africana Studies at Lehigh University, on the positive alternative to grim headlines from Ferguson presented by Monet Davis, the 13-year-old girl pitcher who took the male-dominated Little League World Series by storm.
Next, the trouble with high tech for your ears only. We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Hexelberth with a quote from the news. "We ended up creating one of the most hated tools in the advertiser's toolkit." That was Ethan Zuckerman, head of the Center for Civic Media at MIT, in an essay at the Atlantic Magazine website on the code he developed for pop-up ads to help companies get their ads seen without actually linking them to web pages whose content customers might find objectionable. "I'm sorry," he wrote. "Our intentions were good." Now this.
We're in the computer age, where we headed for internet is all the rage, where we headed for cyberspace is really red, but it seems to be partly good and partly bad, I think. Scrolling down computer screens, till our eyes are red. E-commerce and e-scenes, we should be in bed holding each other tight. Not cyber surfing all night.
The late Susanna McCorkle was an early adopter of mixed feelings about the new technology, and things have only gotten more confusing since then, with more and more things you can see and do with digital assistants and more digital intrusion on our privacy and reshaping of our lives in matters of work, travel, shopping, education, romance, even the very way our brains work.
Where are we headed for? One vision emerges in a recent book, Pardon the Disruption, The Future You Never Saw Coming, by three self-styled futurists, Houston attorney Clayton Rawlings, municipal court judge James Randall Smith, and North Carolina economic analyst Rob Bencini. And to say more about it for your ears only, Clay Rawlings is on the line now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Melissa. I'm proud to be here.
First, tell us how you all became interested in the impact of technology and got together to write about it.
Well, Randy and I have been lifelong friends. We're both ex-DAs for Harris County, and I took the Strategic Foresight Seminar through the University of Houston. It's a week-long program under Dr. Bishop in May of 2010, and that's where I met Rob Bencini, and we've been friends ever since.
Well, let's look at some of the particular threats you consider, beginning with the way you say texting and social media are actually making us less social with impaired verbal communication skills. Say more.
Right, David. With these massively powerful communication tools, the idea was we'll become closer. We'll be able to communicate more, so there'll be more understanding. And the reality, if you're sitting in a restaurant, you look around, you will see people sitting at tables texting and administering their social media and ignoring the human being that is sitting at the table with them. And, I mean, in our home, I have a strict rule. The phones go away when we're sitting down for dinner. But also, it has divided us into groups, and it's called the confirmational bias. If you think, you know, one way, you'll find other people that think that way, and then you'll all be trading stories, reconfirming to each other that you're right. And so we have all these little groups that have alienated themselves from the rest of, you know, the social structure. And then when you look at Twitter, you know, you get, what, 136 characters. So the conversation is banal. People are telling you what they ate for breakfast. Who cares? But deep communication, true, sincere sharing between two human beings has somehow been lost in all of this.
Talk about big data and the loss of privacy, what we say about ourselves every time we click to look, listen, or buy online.
Melissa, that is one of the biggest threats we're looking at. And it's not the Orwellian hell where jackbooted thugs kicked your door down and put a camera in your living room. Instead, technology stripped us of our privacy, and we were willing participants, as well as the Supreme Court of the United States. They ushered in every single thing that happened. Eric Schmidt, the CEO at Google, estimated that from the dawn of recorded history to 2003, we created 5 exabytes of data. That's a 5 with 18 zeros behind it. It's a very big number. However, in 2010, we were making 5 exabytes of data every 2 days. And now in 2014, we're making 5 exabytes of data every 10 minutes. That's an example of an exponential progression. The number is enormous. But all that data flows past us as noise. None of us can use it. But governments and entities like Google with massive mainframes store all that data, and they engage in what's called data mining. They don't need to listen to your phone conversation to know everything about you. They will look at your credit card history. They'll look at your cell phone, locations you are, who the numbers are that you're calling. And by assembling this, they will know your ideology. They'll know how you feel about your government. They'll know if you own a gun. They will know more about you than your next-door neighbor could possibly know. And all of this can be done without listening to a single conversation. It is massively intrusive. And until most recently, when the Supreme Court said that the police have to get a search warrant before they can peruse through your cell phone, that is the first time in the last 20 years I've seen the Supreme Court finally get it and start to push back on this.
Well, I'm glad you got into that area. As a lawyer, you're particularly sensitive to the way our legal system is being eroded, outmoded, or sidestepped by high tech. Give us an example of that.
Perfect example. Many states have gambling against the law. okay? And I don't want to get into should they outlaw it or shouldn't they. I don't care. If a state has outlawed it, it is a sovereign state. It should be able to enforce its law. It can't. There are gambling casinos in Costa Rica that are internet gambling sites. It's legal in Costa Rica. So now, in every home in America, a gambling casino is two clicks of a mouse away in every living room in America. And there is nothing the states can do to stop this. It also rolled over with pornography. But before people say, well, Clay, wait a minute, that's just information, so I'm not worried about that in terms of my sovereignty. I'm still safe in my home. That was true until the advent of the 3D printer. And unfortunately, a law student at the University of Texas, in an act of utter irresponsibility, put an information file on so that a 3D printer will make a fully operational gun. And so, you know, without getting into should we have gun control or not have gun control, if a state passes a law saying convicted felons cannot have guns, a convicted felon with a 3D printer in his garage can manufacture as many guns as he wants. We can't regulate this. We can't stop. We are losing control of our ability to govern ourselves.
Houston attorney Clay Rawlings is a co-author of Pardon the Disruption, The Future You Never Saw Coming from Wasteland Press. Check it out at Amazon.com and Facebook.com/Pardon the Disruption. All one word.
Quote from the news, extremely dangerous, worse than GM's issue. That was the conclusion of a complaint to the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration, among at least 240, about power safety and security failures in Chrysler, Dodge, and Jeep vehicles linked to their total integrated power module, about which a 2013 class action suit also was filed.
Next, Living September Song, Love That Conquers the Age Gap, for your ears only.
We're back for your ears only. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. Today is a miraculous day. That was missionary Dr. Kent Brantley leaving Atlanta's Emory University Hospital after being cleared of Ebola contracted in Liberia, as was his fellow missionary Nancy Wrightbull secretly days earlier. To what degree they were helped by the untested drug ZMapp is not immediately clear. Brantley thanked God and urged continuing attention to the spreading epidemic in Africa, where the death toll approached 1,500. Now this.
But it's a long, long while from May to December, and the days grow short when you reach September.
Lucinda Franks was 26 years old with a Pulitzer Prize for sympathetic reporting on homegrown radicals when she first met Robert Morgenthau. He was more than twice her age, then the fierce federal prosecutor of New York, and soon to become its legendary 8 times reelected Manhattan district attorney. From a prominent, powerful Jewish family, he was also a widower with 5 children. But it wasn't long before passion and pancakes next morning led to a wedding that was never supposed to happen, Franks recalls, and what is now nearly 4 decades of marriage.
With more intimate details than some reviewers find comfortable, inside views of Major Morgenthau cases, and keen observation of the changing times, Franks demonstrates how gaps of age, origins, and politics can be bridged to make love last in a new memoir titled Timeless, Love Morgenthau and Me from Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. And to talk about it all for your ears only, Lucinda Franks joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, David. Nice to be here.
How did you meet?
I was a radical anti-war protester, someone who chained herself to fences and threw pig's blood on draft files. I was with a draft dodger, draft resister, and he said, you should go and interview this guy Morgenthau because Nixon's just fired him and he's a good guy. And I was with United Press International, assigned to the burgeoning Watergate scandal. I went to Morgenthau's office, and I asked so many detailed questions, even how to spell the names of congressmen, that at the end he said to himself, this is either the dumbest or the smartest reporter I've ever met. And when he read my story, he decided I was the smartest.
Talk about how your romance began.
Well, he asked me to party at Arthur Schlesinger's home, and we went there, and it was kind of a fairyland, a ghastly fairyland of women in silk and feather boas coiled around swan-thin necks. I was dressed in platform shoes and bell-bottoms and looked like a homeless person in comparison to these society ladies. But when Jackie Kennedy walked through the door, they dropped their jaws and was smiling dumbly at her. And I looked up at Bob, and he was smiling too, but not at Jackie.
Morgenthau is only 6 years younger than your own father, about whom you wrote an earlier memoir, and like him, a taciturn World War II Navy veteran. Have you come to see that as part of his appeal to you, and has learning about each of them helped you understand the other?
Absolutely. I discovered that my father was a spy for the Navy and for the OSS during World War II, during the end of his life. Found a Nazi uniform in his belongings, and he had always been a very mysterious man. I couldn't really get hold of him, and I think that I married Bob much earlier than this discovery, partly because he was as mysterious as my father, and there was still that need to understand a man who couldn't be understood. And I got to know that both of them had post-traumatic stress syndrome of war.
What about your obligations as a journalist? Did you keep his law enforcement secrets, or did he keep them from you?
We had a pact when we got married, or before we got married, really, that I would never write about anything that he told me in confidence about his cases. He also would not try to influence me in my writing.
Let's talk about some high points of your husband's career. What does he consider his greatest achievement as a prosecutor?
Well, he lobbied very early against the death penalty, and he had a lot of opposition back when there was, a very high crime in New York City in the late 70s. People wanted the death penalty, and finally he got the law changed. Along with other people, but he led the fight.
Talk about his early awareness of the terrorist threat that we came to know as Al-Qaeda and the response he got from other government officials.
Yes, he had a case, the case of Meir Kahane, who was ultra-Orthodox rabbi, was murdered on the street by this terrorist. And boxes and boxes filled with plans for bombing the World Trade Center, bomb materials, blueprints, tapes, and the FBI took them, withheld them from the DA's office so the DA couldn't investigate a terrorist conspiracy, and they never looked at them. Bob warned them that something else was going to come if they didn't examine the boxes, and sure enough, in 1993, a few years later, the World Trade Center was bombed from a truck bomb, in the garage and killed several people. And this was a preamble to 9/11.
Morgenthau is now 95. Do current prosecutors still come to him for advice?
Oh, all the time. He has a line sometimes of people waiting outside his office from the law firm he works in.
Finally, we have to ask about the age gap you bridged so successfully 4 decades ago. How does it look now, and how do you continue to deal with it?
Well, it's a very interesting dilemma because when, you're 30 years apart and the older of you is 95, there are many things you can't do that you had always done together. But we all also find things that we have in common that we never had, knew we had in common before. So we have wonderful discussions. We have as passionate intellectually, as passionate a relationship as we ever had, and other ways too.
The new memoir by Lucinda Franks is timeless, Love, Morgenthau and Me, from Farrar, Straus and Giroux.
Quote from the news, policy is a machete, not a scalpel, and I think people will be more helped than harmed. That was Dr. Nathaniel Katz at Tufts University School of Medicine on the new Drug Enforcement Administration rule to tighten prescription practices for hydrocodone and prevent abuse of the popular painkiller.
Next, how Fiddler went from that roof to Broadway and beyond, for Your Ears Only. A last chorus for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. "The moment you said my name was the height of my career." That's what Saturday Night Live veteran Maya Rudolph told longtime NBC announcer Don Pardo on his induction to the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences Hall of Fame in 2010. The voice of SNL for 38 seasons, Pardo died last week at age 96. Now this.
If I were a rich man, yeah, dear, 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 dear. All day long I'd pity, pity, bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard. If I were a pity, pity, rich, idle, diddle, diddle, diddle man.
It was a September night 50 years ago that the antic genius Zero Mostel first brought the character of Tevye to Broadway in the debut of Fiddler on the Roof. 7 years later, the Israeli actor Topol brought him to movie theaters worldwide. And scarcely has there been a time since that the musical in one form or another has not moved audiences with its tale of joy, sorrow, tradition, and transformation in a Jewish village of Tsarist Russia.
Journalist and author Barbara Eisenberg explores the creation, production, and lasting influence of the show in her new book, Tradition, the highly improbable, ultimately triumphant Broadway to Hollywood story of Fiddler on the Roof, the world's most beloved musical, from St. Martin's Press. And for Your Ears Only, she's on the line now. Welcome to our show.
Thank you very much.
But who first had the bright idea of turning tales of Yiddish writer Sholem Aleichem into a musical?
Well, in this particular case, it was Sheldon Harnick. And what happened was that a friend of his had sent him a Sholem Aleichem novel, which told the story of a group of traveling actors. Now, it was a wonderful novel. Sheldon Harnick loved it. He said, great musical. And he sent it to his collaborator, a man named Jerry Bock, who he had written Fiorella with, the great Tony-winning, Pulitzer Prize-winning musical about the mayor Fiorello LaGuardia. And the two of them thought, this is it. They took it to a collaborator they'd had in the past named Joseph Stein, who said, it's too sprawling. But Joe Stein said, you know, when I was a little boy, my father, who was from Poland, would read to me Sholem Aleichem's stories about Tevye the Dairyman. And I thought, that might make a musical.
Remind us how different Fiddler was from the successful shows on Broadway then.
Well, at that time, when they first started thinking about it, some of the successful shows were Camelot, The Unsinkable Molly Brown. By the time the show came out, even the shows that were on Broadway were Hello, Dolly! And Funny Girl were on Broadway. It was a time when serious shows were not that prevalent. And that actually is one of the things that contributed to Fiddler's legacy. It was a show about something. And before Fiddler, a lot of musicals spoke only to their immediate generation. Fiddler showed that a musical could speak to all generations.
You say it was a labor of love for the show's a trio of Jewish creators and that they put up their own money at the start. But who put up the serious money? How troublesome was it to get investors for a show that was so different from what was popular at the time?
Well, it took them a long time to find a producer. First of all, when they went to Harold Prince, even he turned them down initially because he felt that he was more of a German Jew, and it would be different than the stories of the Russian Jews. Now, eventually, Harold Prince came back, but they had tried other producers along the way, and a lot of people, you know, they said things like, what are we going to do when we run out of Hadassah audiences? And I think part of the thing that saved them was that it was such a passionate for them. It was such a labor of love. And I remember Jerry Bock, the composer, telling me, I think his phrase was actually, I'm not being modest, but we really didn't know what would happen. We just we knew that it was a good show. We knew that we cared about it, but they didn't know.
Talk about how many places the show has played around the world and the funny reaction Joe Stein got to it in Japan.
Well, it's played now in, I'm sure there are very few, it'd probably be easier to name the countries where it has not played, And it is, even in the beginning, it played everywhere from Argentina to, there were 15 productions in Finland in the very early days of it. And so when it first went to Japan, Joseph Stein loved to tell the story about he was meeting with the producer in Japan, and the producer said, I have to ask you, do they understand this show in America? And Joe Stein said, what do you mean? He said, well, it's so Japanese.
Wow.
And, you know, I think it's part of the success of it, that it's so Danish, it's so Israeli, it's so Argentinian. I mean, it's
any
a story
that,
about everyone.
Any place there are families.
Every place there are families and family friction. You know, if you think about it, I mean, everything's in the show of that kind. There's, I mean, there's a well-crafted book, of course, and there's memorable songs. But there's this plot that has something for everyone, whether it's the importance of family, the friction between generations, or the difficult choices that accompany emigration and assimilation.
Barbara Eisenberg's new book is Tradition, the highly improbable, ultimately triumphant Broadway to Hollywood story of Fiddler on the Roof, the world's most beloved musical from St. Martin's Press.
Would it spoil some vast eternal plan if I were a wealthier man?
And this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only on air is also online at iTunes, FeedBurner.com, Stitcher.com, and going back years now at archive.org.
This broadcast was engineered by Justin Ewan at the Hangar Studio Play It Productions. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern. Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts, supported by the Gatewave.org radio reading service for those with disabilities, the Best Memorial Trust, and award-winning ACAM Associates. Exceptional management, impeccable reputation for New York co-ops, condos, and condos. Up since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com. Pledge your tax-deductible donation to davidearsonly@gmail.com.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago.
This week last year, we marked the return to New York of the Sibling Songfest launched there 20 years earlier by sisters Liz and Ann Hampton Calloway from our August 25th, 2013 broadcast hosted by Melissa and me.
Her sisters, they were never such devoted sisters. Never had to have a chaperone, no sir. I'm there to keep my...
The song was written by Irving Berlin in 1954 for the film White Christmas, and sibling roles played by singing star Rosemary Clooney and non-singer Vera Ellen, requiring a vocal dub by the little-known Trudy Stevens. No such problems prevail when done by the real sisters and real singers Liz and Ann Hampton Calloway in their mutual musical romp titled Sibling Revelry. It made its debut in New York nearly 20 years ago and returns there for the first time in 15 years this week at the 54 Below Supper Club.
Liz is an award-winning veteran of musical theater with major roles in Cats, Miss Saigon, Merrily We Roll Along, and more. Ann is an award-winning cabaret diva with more than a dozen CDs of her own on Tracks and many more. She's also a pianist, composer, and lyricist, notably creating songs on the spot from words shouted out by her audience. This weekend, Liz, with the higher voice, is in Oklahoma, and Ann, with the lower, is already in New York. But For Your Ears Only, both sisters join us now to talk about their work apart and together. Liz, Ann, welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Thank you. Did you notice my voice was higher as I said that?
You can untie your shoes.
Hello,
you can untie your shoes later. You both were born in Chicago and a pretty musical town. But was yours a musical family, Anne?
Well, you know, Liz and I have remarked over the years how we didn't realize that we were the Von Trapp family of Chicago. We thought everybody's mother sang torch songs in the middle of the afternoon, and everybody's dad sang scat. And as it turned out, we were pretty lucky and unique in our circle to have such creative and expressive parents. And it was a wonderful childhood to have that kind of inspiration.
Staying with Anne, when and how did you, as a youngster, start making music?
Well, I remember watching my mother play the piano as a baby and just so fascinated with her singing and playing the piano at the same time. And I remember she lifted me up on her lap and put my hands on the piano, and I immediately started my love affair with a piano. And, of course, hearing great music on a record player and inspired me to start singing and making up songs. And I've pretty much, since I can remember, been singing.
And, Liz, when and how did you start performing?
Not the way Anne did. Actually, I was the shy one. I heard all this music in my house, and I was so, so timid about singing in front of anyone. I would wait till everyone would leave the house, and then I would sing. I knew I had a voice, but I just, I was painfully shy. So being a closet singer, I probably didn't really start performing until maybe in high school. But even then, it was very, very difficult for me. It's a little easier now, thank goodness.
Liz, I've heard that you two never sang together in Chicago, which suggests maybe a little rivalry before the revelry. Was there some of that?
Sure. I think it's natural. I think natural for sisters to, or brothers to have some rivalry. You know, for me, Anne was so, you know, the overachieving, you know, big sister, that it was kind of hard to follow in her footsteps. And it wasn't really until Anne left for college that, you know, we realized, and I visited her, we realized how close we were. And then we moved to New York together. I was 18 and she was 21. And we've been best friends ever since.
And I gather that the idea of you doing a show together began with a former guest on this show, Donald Smith, who also created the Mabel Mercer Foundation and annual cabaret conventions to keep the old popular songs alive. Tell us how he worked with you two.
Well, Don was, of course, such a huge force in the cabaret world, and he had really done so much to promote the music. He had actually helped discover me in New York, and when he realized that Liz and I should have done an act a long time before, he finally called us up and said, would you girls put together a show for the Russian Tea Room series I'm producing? And Liz and I spoke to each other, and we realized it was about time that we got together and pooled our resources. And so because of his request, we made our first sister act, which was sort of a precursor to Sibling Revelry, called Together at Last. And it ended up being an incredible, wonderful part of our performing lives.
And Liz, how did you move after that toward musical theater on and off Broadway?
I was doing some shows in high school, and I realized how much I loved it. It actually coincided with our parents got divorced when we were in high school. And I realized by doing shows, I could have almost another family, and I loved the community feeling of being part of a cast. So that's really why I started, you know, doing shows and why I fell in love with it. So when I moved to New York, really the only thing I thought about doing was theater. And so I branched out and started doing concerts and cabaret, you know, quite a bit later, you know, really when Anne and I started doing Sibling Revelry. That was the first kind of non-theater work I did when I got to New York. And I love being able to do all kinds of music. You know, theater is still probably my first love, but I love getting to tour around the world and travel and do all these different concerts. And, of course, there's nothing I love more than singing with Anne.
And,
oh, that's nice.
And so, I'm sorry, excuse me.
I know, it's emotional. We try to do that. And what are the biggest changes in Sibling Revelry since you debuted?
Well, first of all, what you're going to hear is a nice balance between the original show and some updated tweaks in the patter and the a song thrown in and a few new songs in the huge medley. But I think the biggest thing that you'll hear is that we have so much more to bring to the songs from our life experience together. And our love for each other has grown through the years from doing so much performing together. It's really brought us closer together.
Broadway veteran Liz Calloway and cabaret diva Anne Hampton Calloway bring their sibling revelry show back to New York this week at 54 Below, 254 West 54th Street in Manhattan.
When other friendships have been forgot, ours will still be great. Chuck, Chuck, Chuck.
Sisters in Song from our August 25th, 2013 broadcast. Next week, Anne sings at the Jazz Festival in Vail, Colorado, then in Jupiter, Florida, England, South Africa, back to Old Saybrook, Connecticut, and Portland, Oregon, before receiving the Mabel Mercer Award at the Mercer Foundation's 25th Anniversary Cabaret Convention at the Rose Room, Jazz at Lincoln Center in Manhattan.
Liz Calloway's September and October include performing with the Pasadena Pops at the Los Angeles County Arboretum and subsequent gigs in Detroit, Highlands, North Carolina, and New York City. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now Anne and Liz blend their voices and two joyful musical classics.
Forget your troubles.